I'm Mike Vardy, and this is the Productivityist Podcast.
Welcome to the Productivityist Podcast. This is episode 200 of the show. A big milestone here, and I'll get to the thank yous at the end of the episode. But first, I want to thank you for joining me. And I want to thank this week's guest, Will Henshall. He is the CEO and founder of Focus at Will. And this episode is, because it's a celebratory special episode, it is about double the size of a regular episode. Will has a illustrious career, 30-year notable career. He's a startup entrepreneur. He's a tech inventor. He's a musician. He founded the platinum-selling 90s British pop soul band London Beat. There's a song, I've Been Thinking About You and Come Back. Those are Billboard hits. And, you know, he started up Rocket Network in 1996, which ultimately was the invented, like he invented the pro audio media transfer tool, Pro Tools DigiDelivery. We talk about all that stuff. We talk about Focus at Will. We talk about that direct line between happiness and productivity. We get to that point. Maybe we get to that indirectly, but we have a great time talking. It's a great episode. It might take you a couple listens to get through because normally we only do about 25, 30 minutes. This is about an hour. So let's just get to it. Here's my conversation with Will Henshall of Focus at Will here on the Productivityist Podcast 200th episode. Enjoy. I'd like to welcome Will Henshall to the Productivityist Podcast. Will, thanks for joining me today on this 200th episode of the show.
Well, that's exciting.
It is.
Hi. 200. Wow.
Yes. And the funny thing is this is so we're in June now of 2018, and I have to say that this is the 10-year anniversary of me podcasting, which is
wow.
Yeah. It's craziness. And I mean, I started off, and I want to we're going to dive into a lot of great stuff today as we talk about, you know, focus and productivity and happiness and all the stuff that kind of I've been speaking to a lot over the past few years on this show, but even before this podcast, I was talking about on previous podcasts. But I want to for people who don't know who you are, or why you might even be here today. Maybe do a little bit of introduction. And can you start back where people might have heard of you before? Because I know that's kind of where it's a bit of a fascinating story and how it's kind of gotten you where you are now. I think you know what I'm leading towards. Oh,
sure. Well, I had a misspent youth. That's the best way of putting it. I was I'm a songwriter as well as being a scientist and a tech inventor. And the first thing I did when I left school was I was interested in writing songs and being in a recording studio and being a musical artist. And at the age of 27, I had an overnight success of 10 years of incredibly hard work, just nose to the grindstone, just never giving up, with the band London Beat. And London Beat was a British soul band, soul pop band from the 90s. And we had a bunch of number one records between 1990 and 1994. The song that everybody would remember was called I've Been Thinking About You. Woo, 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 woo. You probably remember that. Not me singing it. Of course, I was not the singer in the band, but I was the main writer in the band. And I was the guitarist, and in the studio, I double tracked everything. So I had a period of an 8-year ride, signed to a major label, touring all the, you know, and doing all the things that you see people do, apart from the fact I was sober and happily married, apart from those two things. But touring was a fascinating way of seeing the world and growing up really fast. They say if you visit somewhere as a tourist, you get a very different impression of a city than if you visit somewhere and work there. Mm. It's very interesting. You may go for 2 weeks, you know, imagine going to Toronto, right? For say, for a weekend as a tourist, and you'd be walking along and you'd kind of get a feel, go to some restaurants. But if you're actually gigging in Toronto, if you're actually on Much Music, which is the, or was the, you know, the
still
Canadian
is.
Version of, it's still around, of MTV.
Still is,
right?
Yep.
I played on that many times. You just get a different sense of what people are doing, and sort of, this sort of leads to why I'm here today to an extent, and that is that different cultures and different cities have different work ethics and different ways of managing quality of life. And I learned during this period of my life that being super productive and being incredibly effective at what you do doesn't necessarily equate with happiness, because
right.
you have to, right? So
yeah.
It got me, like, I was like burned out. My dream had come true. I had 2 number one records in the USA, many number one records that I'd written and played on all over the world. And it was burning me out. I was constantly either in the studio trying to recreate it, or I'd be on the road. And I got to the point where the quality of my life was impacting the very thing that I was trying to do, which is be creative and play music that inspires people. So I quit the band in 1994. I've always been interested in technology. I come from a British, I live in California, and I've been here for many years, but I'm originally British, as you can probably tell from the accent. I come from a long line of British inventors, and I've always been interested in computer technology, in software. Weirdly, the way that you record, the process of recording multi-track music, multi-track audio in a recording studio, is very similar to the process of creating software.
Right.
Right? That's a weird thing to say, but it actually is.
It's funny. When I was working, I used to work in college radio back when I was near Toronto. I worked in Hamilton, and I was a college radio in the early 90s. So I was working for McMaster Radio, and it was a college station. And, back then it was reel to reel. Like, a lot of that stuff was done. But then when I moved here to Victoria, everything was digital. And it kind of threw me a little bit, but it was very, it was, and it was interesting because when I was in that college state, and this is, there's actually a bit of a story there, is that I felt that I thought I was going to keep going in that direction, working radio as a uh-huh. DJ, not a very lucrative, sure. But it was great. But once I left Hamilton and moved out to Victoria to work for Costco, which a lot of people would know that that's kind of the trajectory that I went down for a while.
Yeah.
I went to the college station here in Victoria, British Columbia, and they said, "Oh, you've been a DJ before, so you know all this stuff," and everything was digital. And you know, and I think this is related to kind of happiness as well, is that you recognize when a moment was there and it has passed. It is no longer, so I went in and they said, "We'd love it." And I looked around and I said, "No, this doesn't even replace what was there before. It's completely different." And so I was okay with letting that go. How did you, I mean, you obviously had the technology stuff that kind of, usurped took over, and it was something that you kind of had an affinity towards. Was that must have made it much easier for you to let go of the music side of things and allow you to apply some of that creativity towards the technology stuff, right?
Yeah, it did. I was a very early electronic music pioneer and a very early electronic what is now called EDM, electronic dance music, but back in the it was house music, in the 80s. And I was involved in something called the acid house movement, which came out of the UK in 1986 and 7. Mm-hmm. And for any music technologists out there, this was the 909 drum machine and the 303 bass machine that had that sound to it.
Yeah.
and something called a 106, which was a Roland keyboard. And with those three things, you could make this incredibly loud, effective dance music that was in your face when you listened to it loud in a big club. And I got fascinated with this interface of electronic music and humanity. And all my time in the 80s as a record producer, I'd be trying to make drummers play in time. So what we would do is we'd record a drummer and we'd find one bar that was great. And then we'd loop that. Well, I'd literally on the tape machine, you're talking about bits of tape here. I'd literally get a 24 track tape, cut it up and make one awesome bar and then copy that a bunch of times onto another tape. So now finally I had a drum track that was in time. I found out this kind of recently. Here's a crazy bit of music trivia for you. The Bee Gees, remember them?
Yep.
Staying Alive, Staying Alive. They did this, and they had all of their hits were Staying Alive and Grease and all of that stuff they did was done with one drum bar, and then they copied it.
Wow. So
isn't that crazy?
That is.
All of the Bee Gees records, the engineer told me that, I don't know, it's all of them, but most of the hits had the same drum pattern on it. And of course, when we had technology, I was able to go, oh, I don't have to muck about with bits of tape and trying to make this drummer play in time. That early interest in sort of a hybrid of art and audio technology led me to the next thing that I did after I quit the band in 94. And that was... Music had stopped being recorded on tape, multi-track tapes, as we've been talking about. And it started to be recorded on hard drive. And there were two or three companies at the time that were doing this. One, of course, is Pro Tools. Everybody's familiar with that. The first version of Pro Tools was called Sound Tools. And it was very crude, but it would allow you to do two-track digital recording and two-track digital editing. It's very crude. It was slow. It wasn't very reliable. But another thing that happened was I've been online a long time. I was on a system called The Well in the mid-80s, which was a sort of a dial-up internet service back in the day. And for me, even though the modems were very slow, I think my first modem was 9600 baud, 96, may have been less than that. tiny right. Trickle of single digit letters. But I thought, you know, when modems get faster, if they do, this huge audio file, which is 50 megs, will be able to be transmitted over these things. And that got me thinking as the early 90s progressed and as now internet access became faster and the huge file of 50 megs, which was a typical audio track in digital form, that then became possible to transmit over the wires, over the cables. And that had me create something called Rocket Network. And over the next, winding very swiftly on through 2003, I moved to San Francisco and started a company called Rocket Network. We developed something called Digi Delivery, which is now part of the Pro Tools cloud collaboration system.
Wow.
So, and what it does is it networks recording studios.
Oh.
So, like you and I are talking on a line now. We're just using Skype to do this. Of course, there's two of us, right? There's me talking, you're listening. And so I'm in Los Angeles and you're in BC, right?
Yeah.
So, this works, but what if I had a band here? And what if you were the singer? How could we do that? If we were trying to record something, there's actually a delay when I'm talking to you that we're used to, but that delay means you can't actually sync multitracks over a distance. And we figured out how to do it. And it became this thing called Digi Delivery. And then I sold the company, as I said, to Avid in 2003, having had a sort of a vertical learning curve in software development and the patent process. We got 5 patents around this core technology that we sold then to Pro Tools, you know, and taught me a lot about, again, the practical the practical process aspects of, okay, it's one thing to invent something, but how do you make it into a thing? It's 1% invention and inspiration and 99% sheer hell, perspiration, pushing a wet noodle uphill, fighting with developers. Oh my God. Anyway, that is what gave me the sort of the groundwork in these two worlds, which was, you know, achieving some level of notable success in both the arts as a recording artist and as a songwriter and as a technologist developing audio technology. So I'm winding forward right now to the current day. The reason we're talking is that I am the founder of a company called Focus at Will. And we've been going for 6 years, and we are a music service, a streaming music service that plays music that helps you focus and be more productive when you're working and studying.
I'm taking
a breath.
That's good. I'm
exhausted. I need a nap after all that.
So Focus as well. I mean, it's been, like you said, it's been around for several years now. I've used it, still use it. And for those, obviously there'll be links in the show notes and all that stuff to Focus at Will, because you're right. It definitely has it brings us to that level of productivity that you know we talk about here. But I want to circle back a little bit to the evolution. Like you had success as a musician, then you had a success as basically a software developer, you know, for lack of, I'll throw that out there, like you built essentially software, and you've done it again with Focus at Will. But what's it been like transitioning from each one to each one, and where you're at now? Like what have been the lessons? Because I think a lot of people, we hear about serial entrepreneurs, and we hear about people who have the day job and then they have the side hustle, and they're, I mean, I've done that where I had the day job and then I built what we're doing right now was initially a side job, and now it is the thing that earns me a living. There's always these things that are evolving, because I mean, like you said, you blend art and commerce, or the human plus technology, there is the human element there. So what have been like some of the lessons or the takeaways you've had as you've gone from where you were with London Beat and as a musician to where you are now, and what, you know, in terms of maybe just in terms of productivity, success, happiness, that kind of thing.
Sure. There's a third leg to the three-legged stool that I haven't talked about.
Oh, okay. Well, let's talk about it.
And it is to do with entrepreneurial business and fundamentally understanding that a business is viable when you provide a service or a product that really maps at a need in society at a price that people will spend. And I come from a long tradition of entrepreneur inventors. So my granddad ran a TV store back in the UK. I always remember him talking about he wanted to run an ad in the local paper, and the ad would cost him the same as the money he made on selling one television. I just remember him talking about this. So he said, what we're going to do is we're going to run this ad, and I'm going to give away a TV, but then the next person that comes in, they're coming in and they're coming in for free. And I was like, as a kid, just remember thinking, that is such a weird way to look at it. But that is the basis of business. You know, you advertise and you get people coming in. So after I sold the company Rocket Network to Pro Tools, I actually had to work there for a couple of years as part of the deal. And during that time, I learned a huge amount about, you know, the best software developing teams in the world in audio and video at the time were working for Pro Tools for DigiDesign, which is Avid, three different words for the same company. And I, after I did that, I quit completely and decided to do a business. And I ran a photo agency. I've always been interested in photography. And so I ran a retail business. We became part of a here in LA, we partnered up with a well-known event company. And Good Gracious, they were called. And we ran you know, teams of photographers doing all kinds of things, from bar mitzvahs to weddings to, we had a lot of A-list celebs that even now I can't really discuss, where we'd be doing these crazy events and providing photographers for their private, you know, birthdays and weddings and things. It was kind of a crazy time. But what that taught me was a great deal of hands-on experience about actually the retail process, because a business is actually a dollar hitting the business. There's all of these, you know, we get so spun up with, like, you know, Twitter, they haven't turned a profit yet. That is a unicorn. No. And when I have young, you know, entrepreneurs asking me for advice and they got an idea and we're going to revolutionize and disrupt the thing, I'm like, where's the dollar? Come on. Because ultimately, that is what business is. It's about providing a service and adding value to the service and providing value to society, you know? So this third leg, which was another vertical learning curve in how business actually works, running a retail business, running a for-profit. What I mean by that is a non-investment, like day one, we got to make the money this week to cover the rent to pay the people to, you know. I did that for 7 years, and it really honed my entrepreneurial mind. Those three things then led me to Focus at Will, where I was like, we started Focus at Will in 2010. And if I'd have sat with you, Mike, and if I'd said, hey, I'm going to start a music streaming service, and I think we'll be breaking even in sort of 5 years, you would have been like, what? You're insane. What are you talking about? No one has done that. And that's what's happened. We've done it. And part of the reason that we've done it is that we were able to find a niche and a demand that is not met by anybody in the existing music business. We think of music as being entertainment. We think of it as a commodity. You're driving, you put the radio on, and we sing along, and it makes you feel good. And the music, as far as the neuroscience goes, the music actually goes in your ear straight to your pleasure center, which is your limbic system, where you feel things. That's why we like music. But we discovered that a lot of people like to listen to music when they're working and studying. And I was like, you know, I think that's distracting people. I don't know. If you're trying to listen to like Journey or Aerosmith, whatever it is, you're going to be singing along with Yesterday, the Beatles, right? All my troubles seem so, right? You're going to be typing that.
Even subconsciously. Oh, yeah, right. Yeah, yeah. It's the same right. reason why when you fail to capture things, like let's say right. something's in your head, yeah. and I do this a lot when I talk with people, it's like you're writing something, all of a sudden you write out buy milk in an email. You're like, wait a minute. No, I should have written that. Like, it's the same principles, right? I totally agree.
We did some I'm jumping around a little here, but we did some early when we were trying to find out what kind. So Focus at Will is music that is instrumental music, specifically designed, curated, commissioned for the purpose of focus enhancement. And as part of the process, we raised about $5 million, and we're funded by Singularity University and 500 startups and a few other Silicon Valley luminaries. And we actually did some experiments with What is the most distracting music? We're trying to find the least distracting music, music that helps you be productive. But what is the most distracting music? And we found that the most popular bands are the most engaging and the most distracting.
Yeah.
Well, duh. And the one artist that in the lab we just could not ever knock off the top, the top rung of being the most distracting is Snoop Dogg.
Really?
Snoop! Drop it like his heart.
It's got to be his voice too. It's got to be the cadence right? of his. It's got to be that
the cadence of his voice. The yep. little click, 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 click things. Yep. The drop it like his heart, and it measurably slows you down when you're listening to it. The other one we found was again the Beatles. It was She Loves Me, She Loves You. Yeah, yeah, yeah. You put that on, and people are like, "Oh man, you got to turn this off." We were doing standardized tests, which is like, you know, take this, copy this text to this other window, or take this dictation, you know, listen to what people are saying and try and, or do these math problems, you know. So that was how we sort of scientifically started to find out, okay, well, is there music that will make you more productive? To bring it right to this conversation, what kind of music does make you more productive? And why is it some people like to listen to crazy noisy techno and other people like classical music? And 5 years and $5 million and a lot of late nights in the lab, we started to figure out that different people have different types of brain. There's, you could think of them as like personality types. Have you heard of the Myers-Briggs personality types?
Right? Oh, yeah, yeah. Myers-Briggs. I mean, there's a lot of those personality tests. But yes, Myers-Briggs is definitely the most popular.
We use one called the Big Five, which is OCEAN, which mm-hmm. stands for, you probably come across that. It stands for openness, conscientious anxiousness, extrovertism, agreeableness, and neuroticism. And people can be graded on a scale of, you know, 0 to 100 by asking a series of, again, standard psychological questions. At the deepest level, it's like a two-hour exam where they ask you some really whack questions about how do you feel about that thing and how do you feel about that thing we just asked you three questions ago, and is this a pink bunny in a green field or a green bunny in a... It's very kind of strange stuff. But there's a whole discipline and very well-established set of scientific data and agreed consensus on how the Big Five puts people into certain categories. And we discovered that there is a direct link to your Big Five personality type and how easily distracted you are and what kind of music will most effectively help you focus and concentrate. And by the way, a quick spoiler, one person out of three who tries to do this, it won't work at all. So one person out of three can't listen to any music. It just doesn't work statistically for them.
Which is interesting because, and I definitely want to link there. There's because when I'm looking at Focus at Will, and there's two sides to this, and I want to put this out there right now, just because you know it's definitely out there. Is there's an article in Wired which I will link to that talks mm-hmm. about a Focus at Will, and it's funny because the you can tell that, like you said, that percentage of people, if it doesn't work, it's dismissive. It's almost they dismissed, hate it. Right?
Yeah.
That's just ridiculous. It. Like, it doesn't work. it's the same reason. I mean, when, you know, it's the same reason why some people say, I mean, there's always going to be some people who are going to disagree or that it's just not going to mm-hmm. work for. What I find hilarious is that, and I think that this comes down to like our different cognitive biases, right? You know, like mm-hmm. if it doesn't mm-hmm. work for me, then it's not going to work for anybody. And I don't, you know, I think that that's why neuroscience gets a bit of a bad rap, right? Is because people are like, I can't, there's no way. So I'll link, because you see some of the comments and some of them are very much like, you know, yep, no way. But then there's an interesting pocket of people, which I'd like to get to, which is those who have ADHD or ADD. Uh-huh. They're uh-huh. very much like, no, the music does work for me. And I know that yeah. Focus at Will does have, there's actually like settings inside of Focus at Will uh-huh. for that particular spectrum, right?
Well, we have 1.5 million users.
Yeah. Yeah. No.
I don't think
yeah.
this is paying us, you know, it's 100, you know, $99 a year and it's $10 a month. And
right.
I wish everybody was paying us $10 a month. They're not. But all the same, we have a real business and it's kind of, I don't have to prove it. I just look, look at the data, you know. So yeah, you're right that it doesn't work for one person out of three. And they always have a very visceral like, oh, you know, this is ridiculous. So this won't work for anyone. You shouldn't do this.
Yeah.
One more person out of three. So imagine three people, right? One more person out of three. It works. Yeah, it works kind of well for. Yeah, mm-hmm. they don't mind. You know, it's helped me today. Sure. But one person out of three has a oh my God, this is my blankie. I'm never gonna use this again.
It's in the dock in their phones. Like it's like uh-huh. the app, uh-huh. right? Whereas uh-huh. you're right, the middle group is more like I think, and we talked about this before, I'm more in the middle uh-huh. group where I uh-huh. use it frequently, but I don't need to use it all the time. But there uh-huh. are lots of people that, like you say, and let's dive uh-huh. into that. Those people who are like, no, you don't understand. If this works.
Yeah. One of I have a very strong science team, and one of my I don't know if I can have a favorite or not, but we have a psychiatrist on the team whose name is Dr. Ned Hallowell, and mm-hmm. he is a world expert on ADHD or ADD, and he's written the best-selling books. There's one called Driven to Distraction. It's, mm-hmm. it's if you look at books on ADD, you'll find it. Another one called Driven to Distraction at Work. And we're actually mentioned in the books as a company before we met him, interestingly.
Wow.
And through Ned, Edward Hallowell, we have learned a lot about the clinical diagnosis and the clinical, it's something called psychophysiology, which is the study of brain in terms of the function of the brain as opposed to the physical layout of the brain. And what is ADD? Why is this? Because in some countries, including the UK, where I grew up, it is not regarded as a real thing. And that's not true.
No.
That's not true. It is a real thing. Come on. We all know it. So it turns out that about 1 person in 8 or 1 person, about 10% of the population, have some kind of distractibility challenges. In other words, they just get distracted with stuff a lot. And if you think about your own friend group, your social group, you've got those friends. Think about this. We've all got friends who can drink an espresso coffee late at night and go to sleep.
Yeah.
Right? Mm-hmm. What about you, Mike? Can you drink a coffee at night and still sleep?
So yesterday I had a cherry Coke at about 7 o'clock, which from, and it was an imported one. So it was from Great Britain. And I can caffeine and I are friends. I don't really struggle with going to sleep. So yeah, no, I'm more, if it was, I'd say 10 o'clock at night. No, but if it's later in the, like the, I think, what do they say? If you drink caffeine after 4, 5, 6 PM, yeah, like that's probably not a good idea. I can drink it as late as, 9 o'clock at night and be fine.
Yeah. Good. I'm laughing, smiling enormously over here because this shows, they say that it is generally regarded as if you drink a coffee after 4 o'clock or 2 o'clock, my girlfriend can't drink a coffee after noon. Wow. She's like, it keeps her up at night. So we all have a different response to stimulants. Mm-hmm. Stimulants of all kinds, coffee being, caffeine being the obvious one.
And I think our body clocks are different too, right? Like that's the other thing is I'm more of a night owl. So therefore my body, my physiology has kind of said, hey, you know what? I mean, that was from me doing comedy for years. And I'm sure, that's what would happen. I'd finish a show and I'd be raring to go for, the high after a show, the natural high. And then then like 2 a.m. hits and you're like, you're done, right? So that hasn't gone away. Yeah.
Let me jump into what you just said, because you just said, as a comic, you're looking for a natural high. There are some jobs that have a lot of activity. You need a lot of stimulus to do the job. A comic is a great example. Other jobs that some people are really calm in a crisis. Okay, I'm going somewhere with this. So battlefield surgeon, first responders of any type, air traffic controllers, right? Comics, anybody doing live TV or live radio, there's this kind of calm comes over you if you're good at doing this when you're on live TV. And I remember doing my first, I did an MTV Unplugged back in the band days. And I was incredibly nervous about doing my first live MTV Unplugged across millions of people watching. And as soon as I sat down, this calm came over me. And I was like, hey, this feels normal. And so what happens, just to briefly explain, the ADD brain, and I'm quoting Dr. Ned Halliwell here directly, everybody has a clock at the back of their brain, which is keeping us on track. And it's a little like the old slave days when there's a bunch of slaves in the boat and then the guy at the back going, pulls, crack, right? That clock in my brain right now is saying, talk to Mike. And so I can concentrate on you because the clock keeps telling me to do the thing I'm doing. Talk to Mike, right? Now, if that clock is running slowly, what's going to happen? It's going to go, talk to Mike. And now the front part of my brain is like a kid in the backseat of the car going, are we there yet? And I'm looking out the window and I'm going, whoa, look at that. Is that a squirrel? what was I doing? Hey, sorry, Mike, I was drifting, right? So when you are like that, what happens is you need a lot of stimulus to be able to concentrate. Now, evolutionarily, having 1 person in 10 in a tribe able to be calm in a crisis when there's the arrows are coming over, there's crazy stuff happening, and you're able to go, I got this, right? That is a huge advantage. But in our society now, there's not always that many kinds of crises. So people who are good in a crisis, it just means they need a lot of stimulus going on. So this is why Ritalin and Adderall, being amphetamines actually, right, are given to people with ADD, and it calms them down. So if my clock, this is very counterintuitive, if my clock is actually running slowly, my internal mental clock, I can't concentrate because my mind is looking in other places. If I drink a few coffees, it's going to speed my clock up, which means I'm going to be able to concentrate on what you're saying.
Right.
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 So the more ADD or the more easily distracted you are, the slower this clock is in your brain.
Yeah, because it leaves gaps. That's the thing, right? Yeah, because it's leaving gaps for attention, for things to steal your attention away, which is why
exactly.
Yeah, which is why I think it's interesting because productivity. When I talk to people about productivity, it's like, you know what? You need to slow down sometimes to figure out what to do, because if you're just going and looking at a list sequentially, or you're not thinking about it, you're just doing it, you know, instinctively, then you could end up doing the wrong things altogether. So it sounds counterintuitive, just like you're saying, to say, hey, sometimes you need to slow down to make sure you're actually doing the right things, as opposed to just checking off a bunch of boxes or cranking a bunch of widgets. But you're right. It doesn't seem – people would say, well, no, wouldn't the ADHD brain or the attention distracted brain be going a mile a minute? No, it's the other way around, because you've got gaps there that need to be filled.
Ned Halliwell talks about this thing, which is called overfocusing. And as an ADD brain, or just someone who has difficulty concentrating, if you drink a coffee and you find yourself focusing, unless you point yourself at something that needs to be done that is productive, you will find yourself being productive, shuffling things around on your desktop, or putting your stamp collection in order. And so the key, if you are someone who recognizes that you have distraction challenges, is to make sure that when you drink a coffee, or if you're on meds for ADD, that when you take the meds or when you drink a coffee or two, that you're actually already focused on the thing you need to get done. Otherwise, you'll get the feeling and the satisfaction of getting things done, but you're doing the wrong thing.
Right.
It's called over-focusing. And it's a real problem for some people.
So I want to circle back to the idea of, you talked a bit about happiness earlier on, and happiness. And I think this directly ties into, you know, this idea of focus and having, you know, the kind of the will, not to pun this up or whatever, but just have the will to do the right things that will make you happy, as opposed to being productive for productivity's sake. Or, you know, what I think that there's a correlation there that people don't. I mean, people are, again, checking off as many boxes as possible will lead them to success, which will make them happy. You talked about, you know, your journey along the way here. What have you found, you know, in terms of happiness? And you talked about that when you were touring, that, you know, you've got people who live in a place, and we talked about this before, the blue zones of happiness, there's so many things we can dive into, but what have you found when it comes to happiness, productivity, and success? Like, what have you found for yourself?
Well, you hear people talking about this all the time. It's about a quality of life and a balance, a work-life balance and so on, but it's not really that simple. If you're doing something that you love, that is meaningful to you in some way, and during your workday, you're able to get into a flow state of some kind doing that thing that you love, you will find that you are able to be as productive as you possibly can be. I want to talk about a flow state for a minute. People are probably familiar with the idea of athletes being in a flow state. If you look at any sportsman, I was growing up, it was Michael Jordan, you know, and then it was Shaq, you know, in those fields, and Maradona in the football world. These humans have developed the ability to be incredibly relaxed and zen and meditative at the same time as being highly coiled and ready to just perform physically at their absolute, absolute best. I've got a friend here in LA who's a performance coach, and he's coached a lot of he's an Olympic gold medalist cyclist himself. And he was saying that a lot of athletes have the physical ability, but the bit they do not have is the mental focus. It's the ability for stillness and to be able to sustain a flow state, both physically and mentally at the same time. Now, when you're working, you're writing a blog piece, or you're doing some email, or you're writing a code, or you're designing something. You can get into a flow state, a different type of flow state. And I can ask these three questions. Have you ever had a flow state where you lose track of time? You feel a sense of peace and joy in doing the things you're doing, and you feel at one somehow. You just feel at one with the universe. It's this fascinating deep human experience that we've all done. And you can get this playing with your puppy on the beach. You can get this hanging out with your kids. You can get this just walking along with the one you love. You have this sense of profound peace of mind and happiness, and you lose track of time. You go, wow, where did the time go? If you ever say that, you were in a flow state. Now, when you're in a flow state working, you will be generally doing the best work that you're doing. So if your work is, say, you check spreadsheets, if you're working in an accountant's office and your job is to double check those P&Ls, your job is to double check all these very complex cells, the equations make sense. You will be able to find beauty in that, and you will be able to get yourself into a flow state where you're sort of looking at a spreadsheet with soft eyes, and you're able to just intuit where the problem is, if there is one with this spreadsheet. That is where happiness and productivity meet. And you can be in, I've got friends that work in Google and Apple, and they're software engineers. And when you work in those companies, every keystroke is logged, and you're sort of stuck in the hamster wheel of their productivity machine. And if you're not able to find your own flow state on top of the mechanisms that they give you for working on, you're not going to work out there. So I have started to realize that happiness at work is being most productive while you're reaching that state of peace and happiness. I mean, is that where you are, Mike? Does that make sense to you?
Yeah. And I think, so it's funny, I've been reading more about, this is a book, and I'll put a link to the show. It's called Ikigai, which is the Japanese term for, waking up to do what you are meant to do. That's basically kind of the loose translation of it. And flow is talked about, of course. I mean, I'm looking at my bookshelf right now. Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi's book is like staring right back at me, right? So, but for me, I think the hard part for a lot of people is, and this is kind of what I've tried to help people with, and by doing it for myself first, kind of like how you've self-experimented, I've done the same thing, which is how do I get into flow and stay there as long as possible? So I talk about, theming my days. So that way I know what the ideal tasks like the focus should be for that day. So when I finish, like, for example, right now we're doing this on my video day. So we're not doing video right now. But when I'm done talking to you, I won't go, what do I do now? I will say, what video should I be doing now? So it propels me. It funnels my focus. Same thing with what I call mode-based work. So, hey, I'm going into writing mode. What are all the writing things I can do? And you can do that with, like you said, gardening. I did that with gardening the other day. You get out there. I'm not a gardener. But once you're in it, I think that the whole point, and you illustrated this, maybe, I'm going to kind of expand upon it, is what happens when you get in the state of flow is that you get the meshing of qualitative and quantitative work. So you get high quality, but because you're in that flow, you're getting as much of the right things done as possible. So you're able to actually complete more and kind of do less better, I guess, for lack of a better term. I don't think, if you're in the state of flow, I've never heard anyone say, wow, I'm so overwhelmed. Like, if anything, you're overwhelmed by the amazement. That would be it. But you're not overwhelmed. You don't feel overwhelmed. You feel like you are doing the thing that you should be doing at that given moment, and better. And once you put yourself, I mean, we're kind of lucky in that we, for the most part, we have a lot more control over what we do. Mm-hmm. And because so we can not only do that in a particular moment, but we might be able to do that for an entire day, an entire week, or our entire lives. And I think that, like you said, is the goal. That's where, success is subjective, right? Yes. Happiness is subjective, and so is productivity. It's very personal, and I think what you've talked about as we've got to this point is the idea of meshing that tech and humanity. Productivity is not about gross domestic product, and it's not about checking off as many. I mean, it's not about being efficient and effective, because if you're being efficient and effective about the wrong things, you're not being productive. It's about meshing that human component with the tech that can help you facilitate the human component. And I think that's the big thing, is that people need to, I mean, look at you with music. You said, how do I open the door so that I don't have to do this repetitive work? It's a life hack. What you did was a life hack with that stuff, right? Life hacks were designed for. Life hacks, and having worked in the tech industry, that life hacks were designed initially by coders to do the repetitive tasks so they could really do the deeper things that couldn't be hacked. So I think what I love about Focus at Will, and what I love about just studying this kind of stuff, is that you realize that, hey, you know what? If you're spending your time doing productive, you're not necessarily being productive. And if you can leverage technology and leverage frameworks to allow you to do the deep, meaningful work that will provide you with or make you happy, then that's really what we should be striving for more than anything else.
Yes. Yeah. You know, there's two types of distraction. There's like someone's outside with a jackhammer.
Yep.
And then you're in the perfect environment. You're in the library.
Did you hear the jackhammer just now, by the way?
I did not actually know.
But you're right.
Then these are internal distractions, which are actually the problems. You can always move away from the jackhammer, right? But
yes,
it's that little voice, a little voice in your head. The Focus at Will tech, there's kind of two levels for anyone that's interested. First of all, you have a 1 in 3 chance of it not working for you at all. So if it doesn't, sorry, we can't help you. But you have a 2 out of 3 chance it'll work pretty well, and 1 out of 3 chance it'll work great. But when you get into the system, there's an onboarding. We were talking about the Big 5 personality tests. We have a built-in onboarding. It's a channel recommender, and it has an 80% chance of recommending a genre on the system that will work for you, because everybody is really different. And in essence, how it works is the more easily distracted you are in life, the more energy you need in the music stream. So if you are really ADD, like one of Dr. Ned Halliwell's patients, the kind of music that will work best for you is very crazy, aggressive sounding industrial techno from we actually commissioned these guys in Europe to do it. It's nuts. Sounds like a car door slamming again and again at 200 beats per minute.
It's like the jackhammer making music in some respects. It doesn't work for me, but I've listened to it. I'm like, wow. Right. But you're right. There are people that definitely swear by it.
5% of our users listen to that channel 8 hours a day.
Wow, I couldn't.
It's fact. I know, I couldn't either.
I couldn't.
But if your brain is underclocked significantly, what this does is very similar to taking some kind of physical stimulant. What it's doing is it's actually clocking your brain using sympathetic resonance. And so we found actually that you can have the very similar effect of drinking a bunch of coffee or taking stimulants if you're actually on a doctor's prescription for that. Well, you can do a very similar thing by using audio when you're working.
It pushes you to a certain extent. I've noticed music. I find music does that. You talked about this at the very beginning, is we talked about the idea that, you know, music, there's an emotional response. I actually have playlists on Apple Music for every month or every two, sometimes it's 2 months depending, but it's like, why are those songs on there? Because either I listen to it. So for example, right now, LL Cool J's Mama Said Knock You Out is on my April May playlist because we're recording this in May. Why? Because Deadpool 2 is coming out, and that's the song from the trailer. So anything that shows up, I put in that playlist because it acts as a touchstone or a reminder. And I think so what I find is like certain songs, like that's why workout music works for a lot mm-hmm. of people, right? It's mm-hmm. like that's the song that will propel you. So I like watching pro wrestling. That's not a secret to a lot of people listening to the show who've listened for a while.
Good for you.
And only because it's an escape. Like you cannot take it seriously. But those songs are all super like, let's go, I'm going to be the champ, all that stuff. Those songs are on my playlists every once in a while. Why? Because they propel me to move forward. And I can't say this for sure, and you can kind of piggyback off of this, but I would imagine that those high-octane ADHD mixes, because they are so they're just so there. Like, you can't – it's almost like it pushes it pushes you back to the thing you should be working on because the alternative is just so not – it's not conducive to work at all. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yeah, it is literally imagine that you're in the boat with all the other people with the oars, and mm-hmm. you're rowing, and then it's at the back going pull go faster, and that's what it's doing to your brain in a way. It's keeping you on track. It's keeping you concentrating on the thing you're doing. We find that there is a fatigue sets in, and most of the people that use the system, there's a timer built into the Focus at Will app, and most sessions are about 80 to 90 minutes. And you cannot, even if you find that when you find the channel that works and the genre and there's an energy level, there's a few other things the system walks you through to find out. After about 80 or 90 minutes, you've got to stop.
Yeah.
You can't.
Yeah, and I can't use it for short-term tasks either. Right, I don't really use it for the 25-minute Pomodoro-ish type of thing. I'm not a huge fan of Pomodoro anyway. I use it for like the I'm going to sit down right now, and I tend to use it in my – and I'll link to this in the show notes, but I have three horizontal themes that I have throughout my day. So 7 days a week from 8 to 9 a.m. It used to be 9 to 10, but I have to make it 8 to 9 now. I call it maintaining mode. So it's all the low-hanging – because remember, I'm a night owl. So it's all the low-hanging fruit. Like, I could do this kind of stuff half asleep. Yeah. I play it during that hour. Then during my making time between 2 p.m. and 4 p.m., which is according to, again, another Dr. Michael Bruce who studies – I've had him on the show before. You know, Mike. We've talked about
him. He's a friend of mine, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So from 2 to 4 is my prime making time. Again, mm-hmm. Focus at Will is happening. But even then, it doesn't happen for the full stream. 2 hours. There's normally a breaking point at some point. And then in the evening, after there's a 2 hour window, which I call musing from 10 p.m. to 12 a.m. And that's also playing. So that's when I'm either writing in my journal. The only time I don't play it is when I'm meditating, and that's it. Yeah. And I literally probably could do it with the selections I have. But the rest of the day, it generally isn't – I'm not using it as much unless I'm diving – unless I feel like I'm going to – like Friday is my deep work day, so that might be an example of where I use it. But I'm very – I think that, again, it's kind of like having a toolbox. You go, okay, well, what – I want to have a plethora of tools, or you're a golfer. You're like, okay, well, here's my set of clubs. Which club is going to be the most useful for me at this particular point in time? Yes. And I think that for me, Focus at Will is a tool that I use, and I like to have it at my disposal when I need to use it. I don't use it all the time, but I think that that's kind of what you're saying here, right?
Yeah. It's not for entertainment.
No.
If you, in fact, the most powerful button on the app's interface is the skip button. This is counterintuitive if you like listening to music, because if you're trying to work on something and there's a track on in the background that you like or you dislike, you noticed it. And Focus at Will works best when you hear a ding, when the channel starts, when it starts up, and then you don't notice it because you're in that flow state. Wow, time just went by. I did 80 minutes. And then you hear the ding and you're out. So what that skip button is doing is it's teaching the system this track and tracks similar to it don't work well for you and your personal focus profile. And that's the opposite. Usually you play Pandora or Spotify or Apple Music and you're like, oh, I love that song. What is it? I like that. I'm going to make a note of it. So we've actually had to train our users a lot about, hey, this is kind of weird, but if you like a track or you dislike a track, that doesn't count. What matters is that it took you out of your flow state. So skip it.
It's people almost go, well, like... It's like Amazon preferences in a lot of ways. When you're when you're buying books on Amazon, you're like, if you bought this book, you'll probably like this. I'm like, no, I won't. Yeah. Like, I won't.
This is the opposite.
No, you why like did
this,
you ask
we're never
going
to play this again.
Or you're on Facebook, and it's like, why did that put that ad there? I have no interest in that.
Yeah, that's exactly.
Will, before we wrap up, I just want to touch on one more thing. Circling back to the beginning of our conversation, we're talking like about music. You've got a lot of time being consumed with what you're working on now, but do you still find time for like creative pursuits that are in that vein? Like, do you still have, not hobbies, but let's go there. Like, what do you, because I think that there's that too, that is a definite purveyor of and a indicator of happiness as well, right?
It is. If this was a video feed, you would see that I'm actually sitting in my studio with walls of guitars and a bunch of gold records and a bunch of audio gear sitting here. So, yes, I do. I was very proud to find that I had a number one record last year in a few territories in Africa and in the a few other places with a song called I've Been Thinking About You, a band called Good Luck. Mm-hmm. And I 2 days a week, sometimes 2.5 days a week, I actually work as a professional songwriter here in LA, and about half my income comes from that. So I am actively, doing both things, left brain, right brain. Oh, back to the left brain. Oh, no, it's the right brain.
It's like they're working in cahoots. And I mean, the great thing is I think it's important to know that you know, productivity, you know, and this is, I think, a great way to end up. It's not just about doing things that you need to do, but ultimately you want to get to do the things that you want to do. And that that's a big, big component. And I really wanted to have a chance to have a chat with you, Will. Yeah. You know, I've been wanting to have on the show for a while. And especially to celebrate like the 200th episode. This was a longer.
Thank you.
We normally only do like half hour episodes, but this one, but I wanted to make sure. And I mean, for people who are like, you know, yeah, a lot, Focus at Will is a tool that I've used. I have no problem talking about something like that. But I also wanted to dive into some of the stuff that, you know, is related, like distractibility and, you know, I mean, happiness and kind of the evolution of an entrepreneur as well, right? Because this has been a journey and it's an ongoing one. And how, you know, and you know, I mean, it's plus it gives me a chance to do at least a 10-second snippet of a London Beat song at some point during the episode. So there you go.
Please do.
So, Will, where can people go? You know, to find out more about you, what you do, and learn more about Focus at Will and other things that you've got going on.
Well, my email address is will@focusatwill.
There you go.
You can reach me there. We don't have a very active Facebook page. We post occasionally on it, but it turns out to be a huge time distraction for us. You can see what we're doing on there. Our Twitter feed's fairly active too, but you can reach me. I'm always happy to talk to people about productivity. Tell me, is this working for you? More importantly, tell me if it's not. Why? Is there anything I can do to help someone that this doesn't work for? And that's not when I say that, I'm not like trying to think about, oh, I could make some money now. I'm actually genuinely saying, if music doesn't work for you to help you focus, is there something else? What is it? And that's kind of what my focus is right now.
You're moving onto a chair from a stool. There's a fourth leg coming. I can feel it. Will, thanks so much for taking the time today. I really do appreciate it.
A real pleasure, Mike. And I've been a fan of yours as well for a long time. So congratulations in hitting the 200 mark. And I'm honored to have been chosen to be the guest for that milestone.
Well, thanks again for joining me.
All right.
Thanks to Will Henshaw for joining me this week on the show and celebrating this special episode. I'm in the midst of cooking up something kind of cool with Focus at Will as well. Once that's ready to go, I'll share it with you. If you're listening to this as the episode is launched, it's not quite ready yet, but soon. So stay tuned, and I'll make sure that you hear about it. I want to thank everybody that's helped make this show possible, and I'm going to start with
my producer, John Polstra, who has been with me for nearly every step of the way with this podcast. You know, it's been a great journey. You're going to hear really cool stuff that we're working on behind the scenes as well in the next weeks and months to come. Actually, as we're recording this, we're about 3 weeks away, I think, about less than 3 weeks away from me seeing John at a conference in Boise. We haven't seen each other in a while, so I'm looking forward to that. But without John, this show doesn't happen nearly as effectively as it does. So big thanks to my producer, John Polster, for that. Special thanks to my assistant, Claire, as well, who helps put the show together in terms of getting things up, you know, the WordPress posts and up on the where we host it, which is now Transistor. We've moved from Simplecast to Transistor to host the episodes. We've moved that. So thanks to her for organizing that stuff. Thanks to my wife, Anne, who goes through a lot of the material. If I don't have a chance to go through it, she'll go through the books as like a second perspective, because she's not a productivity nerd like me. So she can give me some perspective that I might miss. And kind of keeps me on track with this stuff as well. And, Jim Woods had a lot to do with the show. Even, you know, leading up to episodes you're going to hear, he helped out with show notes and stuff like that. And he's been a great help with productivity. So big thanks to him as well. But big thanks to you for listening. My patrons who have been part of me through Patreon, and we're making some changes there as well. If you want to know more about those changes, you can go to productivityist.com/membership to learn more about that. But all of you, from the people who have supported me through Patreon to you who's listening right now, thank you so much for helping me put together 200 episodes of a show that is about basically personal productivity and time management, intention and attention. And I'm at a point now where I am 10 years into podcasting now, starting off with a podcast about basically as a productivity parody. Commentator, to doing a Canadian pop culture podcast, to doing a show on the 5x5 network, to continuing on to do my own stuff, to doing shows for Work Awesome, who I used to work with. I've been podcasting for a long time, and hitting another big milestone mark with episode 200 here is a big deal. And there's more to come. I love podcasting. I'm not going to be going anywhere anytime soon. In fact, if anything, I'm going to make things even better. So thanks for listening. I'll be back next week with a shiny new episode of the show. Until then, I'm Mike Vardy, the host of the Productivityist podcast, reminding you to stop guessing and start going.